Live from CAP Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. The spring semester is set to begin for hundreds of thousands of students in the California State University system. They're returning to their studies after a winter break in which COVID cases hit record highs in the Golden State, largely due to the highly contagious Omicron variant. As a precaution, 17 of the system's 23 campuses announced they will begin the first weeks into their semesters with primarily or fully remote learning. But a handful of campuses have either begun or plan to begin their semesters with students in the classroom. One of those universities is California State University, Chico, which resumes class on Monday. Although the university boasts a 93% vaccination rate among students and faculty, the virus is still spreading throughout Butte County, where Chico State is located. The seven-day test positivity rate is 22.9%, about 2% higher than the statewide average. The surge is impacting hospital capacity and staffing at Enloe Medical Center, which is located less than a mile from the heart of campus. The decision to move ahead with in-person learning has received both praise and also has raised concerns within the campus community. So I spoke with Chico State's president, Dr. Gail Hutchinson, about the decision and how the university plans to provide a safe learning environment.
To get started, 17 Cal State campuses have announced that they're going to begin the first weeks of their spring semesters with remote learning. Can you walk us through the university's decision to begin your semester with mostly in-person learning amid the spread of the contagious Omicron variant in California?
You bet. And so first and foremost, you must know that every CSU campus is located in its own county with its own public health or county public health department. All of us work to follow the California guidelines, but every county may interpret things a little bit differently. And every county has an infection rate that may vary across all other counties. So we work in very close collaboration with the Butte County Office of Public Health and make sure that they understand what our thinking is every step of the way. And we really look for their support and endorsement of the plans we make. And at this time, we feel that we can go ahead with a limited in-person. So the spring 2022 will mirror that of fall 2021, which is about 60% of our classes will be offered in-person, and a number of services and activities will be available on campus, but we're not really fully at 100%.
What conversations were taking place with the county and public health officials? And I guess what were the main points of rationale that led to the decision to have 60% of in-person learning come spring semester?
We had a highly successful fall semester. 93% of our campus, so our students, faculty, and staff, are vaccinated. And we know today that vaccination is one of the strongest tools we have to combat the coronavirus. With a 93% vaccination rate and now getting ready make sure that all employees and students have boosters, that really, I think, is our first line of protection, which gives us confidence to move forward. With that protection rate that we had in the fall semester, we had a very successful limited in-person 61% fall. And I think we can do the exact same thing this spring. There are exceptions, and people are encouraged to apply for exceptions, of course, and we go through those. And if they're religious or medical and you have verification for them, we certainly approve them. But a 93% vaccination rate is quite good. And also we have masking mandate. We are encouraging testing. We've upped the number of tests that we have available on a daily basis, both PCR, and now we're increasing the number of antigen tests as well. So I think we're very well positioned and very well practiced based on what happened in the fall.
How are students and faculty and staff responding to this decision? I'm sure there's a spectrum of feedback that you've been receiving.
Absolutely. It's mixed. And let's remind ourselves that we are in the pandemic. And I think if you've listened to some of the experts across the country and even the Biden administration, they're beginning the conversation of, we really have to come to terms with the fact that we will be living with COVID and its many variants for some time to come, and finding ways to live with the coronavirus in ways that allow us to engage in safety practices and stay home when we're feeling poorly or test positive, but at the same time, be moving forward and trying to live our lives to the best of our ability. So it's been mixed, but the majority of faculty staff are supportive, in my opinion, and in my opinion, based on all the students that I'm talking to and the excitement that I feel on campus this week, they're very excited to be back.
In a recent interview, you said that you remain confident that Chico State is one of the safest places in Butte County to be. Tell us what the university is doing logistically to ensure that the campus is safe for in-person learning this semester.
I think it comes back to that 93% vaccination rate. Yes, we're in a county where we have a little over 50% fully vaccinated, but with the majority of our faculty, staff, and students vaccinated with a mask requirement in all of our buildings and with other COVID safety protocols, I really do feel confident, and I think a lot of people here do as well, that it's a pretty safe place to be.
You touched upon antigen tests, and I think, as you know, access to testing has been just a huge issue with the rise of Omicron. How is the university helping students and faculty get access to testing?
Sure. So we're working right now with a group that's testing up to 600 PCR tests on a daily basis. We're also asking the county to increase that number and even increase the number of sites they have. And then we'll be setting up a drive-through testing opportunity for our student, staff, and faculty. We're running a booster clinic beginning on February 1st and 2nd, I believe, in the BMU auditorium, which is very exciting. And then I'm just going to, you know, go off on boosters for a moment. If people are eligible for boosters right now, we encourage people to get them. That's going to help with our protection, of course. And I believe CDC changed the requirement from 6 months after your Moderna or Pfizer to 5 months. So if you're eligible, please get vaccinated. And faculty, staff, students have until February 28th, if they're eligible to do so. If they miss that deadline, then we will require, as soon as they're eligible, to get that booster within 14 days.
You mentioned that 93% of Chico State student and faculty and staff are fully vaccinated. Do you know how many of your staff and students have received their booster?
That we don't, and we're working on that. So we're the Chancellor's office is providing us an opportunity to be able to collect that information. We're just waiting on when we'll get that software. So we're collecting manually. Actually, we're collecting manually right now. We don't want people to have to upload twice. So we're in transition with that, but it's moving smoothly. We'll have it soon.
And you mentioned that February 28th deadline, they would then have an additional 14 days to get a booster shot if they fall within that window. What happens after the 14-day period if they don't get the booster?
So for our faculty and staff, we have our union agreement, so we will have to work through meet and confer on that. With our students have been really great in complying. But for those students who are not fully online and don't attest to not coming on campus at all, they will be dropped. In the fall, I think that ended up being about 15 students, and I expect that it'll be an extremely low number again this spring.
Just looking across the country and even in California at public schools at the secondary and primary level, you know, they've had to kind of, you know, backtrack and go to remote learning after welcoming students back in class. Is there a plan in place if COVID cases on campus or in the community get to a point where the university ultimately decides it needs to switch to fully remote learning?
You know, I think that's a very important question. And of course, we will continue to watch what's happening in the county and what's happening with the spread of Omicron or any other variant that comes our way. And I think, yes, there is a possibility. What I'm hoping for, though, is that we manage, if you will, that we work to control, and understanding that we may have to engage with one another and then maybe stop out because we're feeling poorly or we've been exposed or tested positive. So I think it's the same mantra that we had in the fall, that we're going to manage it. And we managed cases on campus all fall. I do expect a little bit of an increase when people return to campus, but I've asked people to work with their directors, department chairs, deans, to really figure out how we're going to accommodate infection when it pops up in an area on campus.
And obviously, Chico State is among a handful of Cal State campuses that are going to opt for some type of in-person learning come spring semester. Cal State Monterey Bay is another campus that's beginning their spring semester with in-person learning. And in their announcement, the university president stated that the cumulative effects of remote instruction created a real and significant adverse impact on student mental health and could hinder students' progress towards completing their degrees. This is a larger conversation that's taking place as we're in the third year of a pandemic. How has ongoing remote learning impacted students at Chico State?
I'm going to begin by saying that the pandemic has had a significant impact on students' mental health. And so trying to, you know, live with uncertainty, ambiguity, fear, all of this has really played into, you know, our students' well-being. And so we've increased the number of mental health services that we provide our students, and our counselors are working as best they can. We've also encouraged faculty and staff and advisors to reach out to students and connect with them. I think what we've seen is that students really wish to be in person. They struggle with social isolation, and social isolation can contribute to anyone who is having mental health challenges and even depression. So having opportunities then to engage safely on campus is so very, very important. But in terms of saying online or in person, I think we need to remember the pandemic itself has just been extremely stressful.
I mean, each campus, as you really led with, is unique in its decision-making because it's in its own county with its own public health orders. Sonoma State, although most classes will be online, but if a faculty member determines a course is best taught in person, they can request approval and would have to do so through their dean. There's just a lot of options to weigh through. How did your university consider the different options before making a final decision?
So I consider all of these options and have encouraged our faculty to really work closely with their deans and department chairs to best determine what would work best, right? But I am adamant that any class that's been scheduled for in-person, unless there's a really compelling reason, needs to remain scheduled in-person. The caveat there is understanding that if someone comes down with COVID, that we certainly have to work to manage it and accommodate the class accordingly.
Yeah. And I guess, how will your campus monitor the spread of or cases of COVID across Butte County and continue to communicate with local health experts?
So we have great relations with our Butte County Office of Public Health. And so we communicate with them very often, as we do other experts in the area. But I will tell you this, that the monitoring is going to be through the testing that we do and through people who are calling into our COVID hotline, which is very, very important. And what we're asking is that if people test, if people have questions, if people are really feeling uncertain, that they call our COVID hotline, and that's available on our website. And then they work very, very closely with their faculty member. What we want is that if students are feeling poorly or are symptomatic and they decide to stay home, that they are in touch with their faculty members, so faculty member can work with them on alternative assignments that keep them making progress toward their coursework and certainly toward their degree.
What rules are in place if a student tests positive but they're asymptomatic?
So if you're testing positive, we still want you to stay home. You know that the CDC has changed its requirement. So if you're asymptomatic or your symptoms are resolved, they're saying that, you know, you can have a 5-day isolation period. I will say this, that I'm very interested that if you have a tested positive, at the end of 5 days, you've got to have a negative test and no symptoms. So that's one difference, if you will, that we're really pushing, is that after 5 days, you've got a negative test, no symptoms before coming back. And then certainly people will be masked up and hopefully keeping their distance from one another.
On Tuesday, we spoke with Dr. Marcia Nelson. She's the chief medical officer at Enloe Medical Center in Chico, and they've seen a rise in COVID cases recently, which is common across hospitals statewide and across the country. But she was talking about the cases being among younger demographics. And we did ask for her personal opinion, you know, about Chico State going back to in-person learning as someone who works in public health and whose hospital is less than a mile from the campus. if she supports the university's decision to begin the spring semester with in-person learning. And just to paraphrase, her response was about the community at large. And she said the short answer is yes, that she thinks that people could come back safely. Her fingers were crossed about what it will do with their visits, their hospital visits to prompt care in the emergency department, but it can be done safely. So they'll just wait and see, but they're ready for anything. And she really highlighted following masking and kind of following those public health guidelines. So I guess, how is the campus going to ensure that those are being followed?
So I think have a proven track record, actually, because we did very well in the fall. And she's absolutely right. So if you look at the statistics in terms of hospitalizations that we had in the fall at the surge of Delta variant, in some ways, it's very similar at this moment in time. And again, we've managed successfully. So I appreciate her opinion, and I think we're going to make it.
What are you going to be focusing on over the next few weeks to gauge how the campus is doing in managing COVID and cases?
Beginning with the 1,900 students that we have moving into the residence hall at the end of this week, we're going to make sure that we watch them very, very closely. I think they will be a very good indicator as to perhaps the spread that we see that exists in the student population. We've got roughly 14,250 students coming back, and I think, you know, a good many of them are going to be living in town, right? So keeping an eye on those 1,900 and also knowing that what we have established in the residence hall is pretty strict protocol, as we do throughout the entire campus. So again, watching testing, watching for the number of increases in cases that we have, but understanding full well that we can manage cases that we have here on campus, I'll be watching all of those numbers very carefully.
Your students and faculty have endured so much since 2018, the campfire, and I believe those students would now be seniors now. How is everyone doing as we enter year three of the pandemic?
Thank you for that question. You know, beginning with actually the Oroville spillway, the dam breach, if you will, and then with the campfire.
In 2017, yeah.
Correct. So it's been a very long time. It seems like we've mitigated one disaster after another, and now a pandemic. I think all things considered, I think our students, our faculty, our staff, our community are doing extremely well. In times of challenge like this, my heart is warmed, honestly, by the way people come together to support one another. But it's not without, you know, significant impact. And I think where we see that is on the mental health and well-being challenges that our students are faced with. And so we're doing the best we can to really provide them with the support necessary. And at the same time, applaud them, celebrate them for how resilient and persistent and successful they continue to be. I mean, you know, they are well prepared for the future, and my confidence is with them.
Finally, I'm sure a lot of plans are already in place, or students are already thinking about commencement. Last year's spring commencement was limited to graduates only to comply with local health orders. When do you anticipate making a decision about this semester's commencement ceremonies?
I think we're going to be, again, weighing everything very carefully, but I think we'll be having a decision by mid-February, end of February latest, because people have to make plans for coming back to Chico.
And that is Dr. Gail Hutchinson, president of Cal State Chico, or actually just Chico State, California State University Chico, explaining the university's decision to begin the spring semester with mostly in-person learning. Up next, California's housing crisis isn't new news, but finding a solution to it, we are all ears. We'll learn about the city of South Lake Tahoe's new approach to finding affordable housing for locals. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, CAP Radio. I'm Vicki Gonzalez. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. When we hear the term housing crisis, a lot of times we may think it's exclusive to the larger cities in our state. But there are smaller communities which are suffering. Moderate income residents forced out by those rising rents, and buying a place just seems totally out of reach. One example is South Lake Tahoe. Despite the city's tourism industry, supporting and sustaining a living wage has become increasingly challenging. challenging, especially during the pandemic. Now, the city is partnering with an organization to help get more people into more vacant homes. Joining us to talk about the issue of housing insecurity in South Lake Tahoe is the city's housing manager, Zachary Thomas. And Colin Frolick is the founder of a company called Landing Locals. That's based in Truckee, which is partnered with South Lake Tahoe on a new incentive program. Thank you both for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
Thank you, Vicky. Happy to be here.
Happy to have you. Colin and Zach, before we dive into the growing unaffordability in the South Lake Tahoe area, Colin, let's start with you. Can you explain this new program in South Lake Tahoe called Lease to Locals?
Sure, yeah. So Lease to Locals, as you called out, is a program intended at converting vacation homes and rooms and properties that are available either partially throughout the year for tourism to try to convert them into the long-term rental pool, providing incentives to owners to do that. We can get into the specifics, but the idea really is that we can provide owners up to $10,000 if they're willing to convert their property into a long-term rental for our moderate income households.
Your startup is based in Truckee. How long has it been around?
Yeah, good question. So Landing Locals came to fruition in late 2018. My wife and I moved here and started looking for housing, knew there was a sea of housing inventory, but it wasn't just about affordability, but also just availability. And so we originally were seed funded by the Tahoe Truckee Community Foundation and wanted to build a marketplace to connect second homeowners and locals looking for housing. The company then started to partner with local governments, including the town of Truckee, and now most recently the city of South Lake Tahoe, to build out and administer these incentive programs. So it's a really interesting sort of multi-government and multi-county collaboration. And so, yeah, we're very, very enthused with our early results here as well.
Zach, city manager Joe Irvin stated that the housing crisis in South Lake Tahoe is at a critical juncture. How will this pilot program help alleviate that crisis?
Absolutely. What the city manager said is 100% correct. And what, as a result, what the city council is doing is really taking kind of an all hands on deck approach, if you will. And really, this partnership is part of that creative approach that really embodies looking for solutions across the total spectrum of, you know, trying to address the housing needs. And what makes, you know, I think South Lake Tahoe or even the Tahoe region somewhat unique and compared to maybe Sacramento is our rather sizable inventory of vacant second homes. And really that was viewed as something that by the council should be approached really aggressively in terms of trying to take on that, what you might consider low-hanging fruit. Why not maximize the use of existing housing stock you already have? So really it was partnering with Landing Locals to help administer this program and the city council allocating some funding for this. And again, it's part of the multi-pronged approach that the city is taking in addressing affordable housing. And as mentioned, this is really geared towards that moderate income level. That's an income level that a lot of the subsidy programs and other programs that we use really doesn't address. And so this is a creative way to help reach that market.
Well, if you are a resident that's interested in applying and looking into this, what is the household income what is the threshold for a household income to qualify for this program?
Yeah, absolutely. That's a great question. And it took a creative approach to kind of figure out what that targeting household income would be. And I think Colin and I could kind of tag team this answer a little bit, but I'll start out. And really what we were going for is a moderate income average. And so what we're taking is basically an average income of the area. So about in the $79,000 range average for the household. And obviously households vary. There's married couple households, there's non-married couple households, there's single adult households with children. So the idea is to somehow try to distribute the program and the benefit of the program equally to benefit the most amount of people while also providing the opportunity for residents to get into these housing housing situation that they can afford, knowing that a single parent household, perhaps with two kids, might be able to afford a little bit less than a coupled household with two incomes.
Colin, well, so if the household is making, you know, around $79,000, which is 125% of the area median income, what will rent potentially look like for, you know, a one or two bedroom?
Yeah, that's a great question. So to layer on to that in terms of what Zach said, on the renter side, we have these income restrictions. So we make sure that the houses stay in the moderate income household pool. And then we also have rent caps in place. And so on landinglocals.com, you can find what each of those rent caps are. They're based on the size of the property. But the idea there is that we can also control affordability. So for example, a four-bedroom house cannot rent out for more than $3,100 a month, and a one-bedroom house cannot rent out for more than $2,000, and it kind of cascades between those. And the other interesting thing here to try to maximize the use of these homes is that the grants are actually tied per person housed. And so we talked about this as up to $10,000. The way to think about this, both for the homeowners and the renters, is that the more people you house, the more of the incentive that you can unlock. And they're in increments of $2,000. So just to give you a real life example, if a homeowner reached out and said, I have an extra room I'd like to rent to one person, they'd be going after that $2,000 incentive to rent to one person. If someone said, I have a whole home I want to rent out to, you know, to a family or a group of roommates, and it's a four bedroom house, they could unlock that highest tier up to $10,000. And again, all the sort of details are available at landinglocals.com. And if you're a renter, you can also fill out a renter profile. Let us know what you're looking for. Are you looking for a room? Are you a group of roommates, a family, your income, all of that, so that we can connect you with interested property owners as well.
Yeah, I mean, when it comes to those grants, Zach, you know, the city is kicking in, you know, $500,000. Where is that money coming from?
Yeah, that's a great question, Vicky, because that's really the crux of addressing affordable housing challenges is the money, is the funding. And the city took a really creative approach with this, the city council, and took advantage of kind of a less than optimal situation, but tried to make the best of it. And that is using the COVID stimulus money, the ARPA money, to fund this program. And really what's great about this is that it's a pilot program. It allowed us to get it up and running very fast. It uses stimulus money for the very purpose it's intended to, which is help the community, help with housing, and to do it quickly. And so that's really what's great about the use of this funding is it really kicks it into the community in the quickest way possible. And that's where we got the initial funding for this pilot program.
The program has been up and running for a few weeks now, I believe. What has the response and the reception been like?
Yeah, I can take that one. So Landing Locals has done some minimal marketing on behalf of the program. Recognize that the middle of the winter is not the most ideal time for people to move into property. So what we're trying to do is get in front of homeowners, specifically second homeowners that might be up at their property thinking about what they want to do with it in the future. And so far, we've had 75 interested property owners reach out. A lot of these are people that are thinking about their spring and summer plans. And it ranges everything from a room up to whole homes and a lot of folks that are sort of interested in just planting the seeds and getting to understand what their options might look like, understand the mechanics of the program. And then our plan really is just to kind of keep the gas on in terms of marketing. We'll do direct mail to second homeowners at their home address. So as Zach called out, our opportunity here is in finding empty second homes. So we hit them in their home address, oftentimes in the Bay Area or Sacramento or the surrounding sort of, you know, driving distance away from South Lake Tahoe. And then we hope to take some, you know, creative approaches on marketing and find folks that might have an open room if they live full time. So this isn't limited just to second homes. This could be empty nesters. This could be folks that have, you know, a house that they're, you know, buying just now and thinking about what are my options. And so this is a great incentive for people that where it makes sense. You know, I think that's the key here is that this is something that people opt into. And it has to make sense for them financially. It has to make sense for their unique case. And so it's going to take some time, but we're really enthused and encouraged to see that we've had 75 homeowners reaching out and property managers reaching out. And I expect that we'll see the snowball just continue to kind of roll down the hill here.
Well, given that Lease to Locals is the second program, the one in Salt Lake, South Lake Tahoe, because you're based in Truckee, I'm curious, what kind of response or do you view yourself as being in competition with other short-term rental sites like Airbnb or VRBO?
Yeah, that's a great question. So this is definitely not in competition with those. What we look at is that there needs to be a healthy balance. South Lake Tahoe has a unique case that the voters initiated a measure in 2018 called Measure T to revoke short-term rental permits for the bulk of the houses that had them. So, we're a little bit different in South Lake than we are in North Lake Tahoe, where we still have most of the active short-term rentals. The way we look at this, at least in the approach that Landing Locals takes, is that we are a tourist-based economy. We need tourism. It makes sense for some homes to be short-term rentals and some homes to be seasonal rentals and some to be long-term rentals. And what we're trying to do with this program is give people the option that if that makes sense for them financially, that there's an additional incentive on top of the rent that they could collect. And there's pros and cons to all different uses of, using your vacation home. If you use it as a short-term rental, you open yourselves up to the, weekend risk of a lot of turnover and a lot of wear and tear on the house. If you rent it long-term, you open yourself up to other risk with long-term tenants. But really what we say to people is we want to try to find, a healthy balance here. And what's happened is over time, we've had more and more of the housing stock removed from the long-term rental pool. So the goal of these Lease to Locals programs is to try to bring those back to the long-term rental pool. And as Zach said, find creative ways to move quickly and provide incentives to homeowners to do that.
You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio, and if you're just joining us, we're speaking with South Lake Tahoe Housing Manager Zachary Thomas and Colin Frolick, founder of Landing Locals, about a new program that helps residents find affordable housing by incentivizing property owners to turn their vacation homes into long-term rentals. Zach, for a little more context, South Lake Tahoe is a city of just over 20,000 residents. At last check, the unemployment rate hovers around 6.3%, which is slightly above the national average. Can you just give us a snapshot of the economy in South Lake Tahoe and what has led to housing insecurity over the past several years?
Yeah, that's a great question, Vicki, and a complex one. Fundamentally speaking, access to safe and affordable housing is one of the most important things to having a healthy local economy. And I think we're seeing that play out in real time here. On one level, we have record tourism, record home prices. A lot of metrics point to a very healthy economy. At the same time, we have businesses struggling greatly with trying to find employees and retain employees. That goes across the income spectrum. That goes all the way from your kind of tourist industry workers all the way up to medical staff workers. And that's really what's happening here. That's really what's driving this multi-pronged approach that the city's doing, is recognizing that housing, the lack of housing, isn't just at the low income level, and it is there. And there's a lot of effort to address that. It's also at this moderate income level and even higher. And so that's really kind of what we're seeing with this drag, if you will, on the local economy, that on one level is very healthy, but on another level, local businesses are struggling greatly with the challenge of retaining employees. I would say that's the number one issue happening here.
Yeah, there's a lot of nuances to this, especially given it is a tourism-based economy. Colin, since you have a similar Lease to Locals program in Colorado, can you talk to us about kind of the unique challenges you see in resort or tourism-driven markets like Tahoe?
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely something that is not unique to the Tahoe area. So Landing Locals also operates the Lease to Locals program in Summit County, Colorado. They had reached out to us when hearing about the Truckee pilot we had run a year ago. And we crafted a really unique program there, which was exactly geared at converting short-term rentals back into long-term and seasonal rentals. with some really big numbers as well. So our incentives in the Tahoe area are up to $10,000 per home converted, and theirs are up to $24,000 initially. Wow. So pretty staggering numbers, and saw some really great early success there. You know, what's unique about each of these places, is, as Zach called out, is we have really healthy ecosystems in terms of tourism and the foundation for a lot of economic activity, but we have a lot of sort of unintended consequences or byproducts of over-tourism. And this is, you know, happening all over the country. This is happening in Hudson Valley, New York, and Cape Cod, and Nantucket, and every place that historically had been a, you know, seasonal or tourist resort town. We focused a lot of our efforts so far on the Western mountain towns, and have done work in Big Sky, Montana, and Telluride, Summit County, Colorado, and then all of Tahoe. We're finding that there's a lot of commonalities, and we're finding a lot of interest from towns. Almost every day, another town reaches out to Landing Locals and says, how can we bring a Lease to Locals type program to our community, because we're suffering, and you know, a lot of the sort of pain points are very similar in terms of businesses and local employees. While we have sort of this booming economy in a lot of ways, as Zach said, the metrics of housing prices and the area median incomes goes up when people with remote jobs come and move into the area. But that doesn't, rising tide doesn't lift all boats in that case. And so it's a complex and unique situation that we're seeing in dozens and dozens of tourist towns across the country, and we hope to be able to provide kind of insights and bring programs like Lease to Locals to other places. So far, as I said, we're in three major areas, but we definitely are gearing up for more growth and expansion with these programs in the future.
I mean, the whole goal for this is a win-win situation for someone that needs housing and someone that has a home. Zach, you mentioned this is a pilot program and it was funded with COVID relief funding. If it is indeed a win-win situation and you want to continue it, have you had discussions with the city about sustainable funding?
Absolutely. That's a primary strategy in terms of our addressing housing needs, is developing a sustainable funding source. As to date, the city has allocated a significant amount of money towards the construction of new affordable housing. And that's being used to leverage large amounts of outside grants. That's been very successful. We're exploring ways to maintain a sustainable funding source locally for programs such as this that benefit from a funding source not necessarily tied to the requirements that are specific to grants, both at a federal and state level. And really, the advantage of a local funding source would be kind of flexibility in using it for creative programs that are somewhat kind of outside the box, if you will, like this. And so absolutely, that's one of our top goals for the next year.
South Lake Tahoe Housing Manager Zachary Thomas and Colin Frolick, founder of Landing Locals, thank you both for joining us this morning.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you. Thank you, Vicki.
And if you'd like more information about the Lease to Locals program, we have a link posted right now at capradio.org/insight. Still ahead, we turn the page on a dark topic in California history. Amid the most infamous crimes that gripped our state, one author is shining light on lesser-known California murders which have faded from memory. You're listening to Insight here on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. We're back in just a moment. Welcome back to Insight on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. True crime, the genre which has exploded in popularity over the years. From documentaries to podcasts, books, and streaming series, many of them focus on the gritty, morbid details of some of the country's most infamous murders. California is no stranger to serial killers and murders which captured the attention of the entire country and the world. True stories in which lives were shattered or changed forever through senseless acts of violence. But one author is shining a light on lesser known California murders which have faded from memory. That author is David Kolchek, a crime historian who lives right here in Sacramento, and he's here to share with us his new book, Forgotten California Murders from 1915 to 1968. David, welcome to Insight.
Well, it's nice to be back.
Well, this book is now your seventh book and the fifth one focusing on murders in California.
Where did your fascination in homicides come from? Five books.
Well, partially is because I read about so many of the same crimes and murderers and criminals that I felt that there had to have been other ones to write about. And I was right. I started this about 20 years ago.
The book is profiling murders in California from 1915 to 1968. That's a very specific time frame. Why that time frame?
Well, 1915 is when the newspapers really got modern. And then 1968, after that, the crimes quit being so fun or interesting. You know, it started more on concentrated on serial killers and things like that, where, you know, yeah, where there was an explosion of serial killers. So that 68 is a good cutoff point.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, you're going back more than a century. Were you able to find any family members of who are connected to these crimes and murders through your research?
Not with this book, but with other ones I have.
Great. What goes into researching for a book like this?
You know, I've been doing this a long time, and so I have a lot of yellow notepads full of dates and names and things like that. And I belong to a couple of newspaper websites, and I'll just look at newspapers. And a lot of times I'll be looking up something and I'll see in the column next to it another crime that's even more interesting.
Well, let's get to some of them. I mean, let's take a look at some of these cases from our region, actually, that you chose from the book. This one was more than a century ago, October of 1921, right here in Sacramento, in what you think may have been one of the earliest cases of road rage in the capital. It's called Pioneer Road Rage. Tell us about it.
Yeah, this might be the earliest case of road rage recorded. It happened shortly before midnight. And it was a Sunday, October 30th. There are people all over the place. I find this really interesting about Sacramento in the older days, is that things were open late and people were out late all the time. So here it is, like midnight on a Sunday. There's people all over the place. At the corner of 24th and M Street, this carload of people, was Ernest Beale and his wife Irene, and friends Marion Collins and Clarence McShane. They were driving a car that wasn't really street worthy. And, you know, if you can imagine 1921, the cars then, and if this car was that much of a piece of junk, you know, it's pretty bad. So they got cut off by this guy, and they yelled at him, and he yelled back, and they took off after him. This guy was Albert Pappy, who was a German immigrant. He was an American citizen. He was coming back from a dance that him and a friend had put on, and he had all the money from the box office.
Oh.
So he didn't think anything of the people shouting at him. You know, it was another night in Midtown, you know, just like now. And he pulled up in front of his house on M Street, and the Beale guy and his friend pulled up right behind him and got out. He thought he was being robbed. So he took this metal pipe that was an anti-theft device back in those days, and you put it in the tires of your car, and he hit the guy with the pipe and ran into his house. And the guy died a couple of days later. And they had a trial and everything, and he ended up being acquitted. Lived to be 85 years old.
Wow. Well, let's kind of stay in that time range, actually go back a few years earlier. In Sacramento, there was an unsolved case. This is interesting, involving garbage men and dynamite. This took place January 2nd of 1916. I actually learned about, you know, the city's sanitation practices going back to 1916. Tell us about it.
Yeah, back then, the sanitation was unregulated, and it was run by, at least in Midtown and downtown, by Italians. There was this group of six guys, and some of them were brothers and they were cousins, and they had a garbage hauling company. January 2nd, everyone was still celebrating 1916, And about midnight that night, a package, a smoking package, flew through the window of Marie Apostolano. These are really Italian names that are hard to pronounce. But the smoking package fell into her kitchen. She picked it up and just put it into her cast iron stove. Like, that's what you do when you find a smoking package that flew through your window at midnight. And so she just walked away, and her husband and uncle came over, and they were standing in front of the stove, and it blew up. It was full of dynamite. And blew up the house, killed 4 people. And there were like body parts scattered all over the place. The house is still there, oddly enough. I don't know if it was rebuilt or if it was just fixed, but the house is still here. I like to keep addresses in all these stories.
Was the crime ever solved?
Never solved. A lot of times, especially back in those days, when it came to ethnic minorities, the police would round up the usual suspects, and then they would just shrug their shoulders, going like, I can't figure out this Italian stuff or this Slavic stuff or this, you know, African-American stuff. It's just the way they did it. They just kind of let everybody have their own little rules.
Yeah. Why do you believe these forgotten murders are worth remembering?
Well, you know, somebody's life was taken. And definitely lives were ruined. And, you know, murder is a great taboo. And, you know, I was talking to a friend once, and he brought up that his grandfather was murdered in like 1922 in Seattle. And it's like, who would remember that, you know? And he was probably the last of his family to remember that story, you know?
Yeah, and you're continuing that, you know, by doing these books. What do you want readers to take away when they finish this latest book?
Oh, just that things have never really changed, that there's always going to be crime and murder, and there's always going to be people interested in those things. Like you said about how many different crime programs there are on TV and stuff. I was on 3 episodes of The Dead Files last year, and this year I'm going to be on, I hosted an episode of Snapped that's going to be on sometime this spring.
Oh, great.
Yeah, people are just very interested in crime and murder. Yeah, I think a lot of it is that none of us will murder anymore. So it's kind of like when you read about it, you wonder, like, how could this happen? How could somebody actually murder someone? Because, you know, the majority of us will never do such a thing or even think about it.
Yeah. Yeah. It's definitely hard to wrap your head around. What did you have to actually narrow down the cases to the ones that you selected in this book?
Yeah. In all my books, it's like that. For every chapter I write about, there's like 3 to 5 that I scrap.
That's interesting. And, David, thank you so much for joining us and sharing your latest book. Where can people get it?
Well, you can get it at Amazon, of course, and any bookstore. Time Tested Books has all my books in stock all the time. That's always a good place to go. But yeah, it could be reached Amazon or anywhere you need to find the book.
Thank you so much, David.
Thank you.
David Kolchek is an author and homicide historian from Sacramento, sharing with us some of the state's forgotten homicide cases, highlighted in his latest book, Forgotten California Murders, from 1915 to 1968. That's it for Insight today. You can learn more about our guests at capradio.org/insight. You can also subscribe to the Insight podcast on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. Thank you to producers Cynthia Lopez and Nick Dobis, with managing editor Aram Sarkissian. Our digital team is Chris Hagen, Emily Zentner, Helga Salinas, and Megan Minata. Insight's technical director is Mark Jones, and our engineer, Chris Feltz. Joe Barr is Cap Radio's chief content officer. And I'm Vicki Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us. We'll catch you back here tomorrow.